This is fun! The FU Network.
It's time once again for the Broken Clock Podcast. And as promised, my partner in thought crime, Mouse Mary, just and I are going to talk about how to get people to start thinking more critically. And as usual, we are going to use current events that people search for to use as examples, because that's the way search engine optimization rules in 2020. So, Mouse, we're going to set up. Or to level set, as people say all the time now. We're going to talk Joe Biden / Tara Reid. Oh, terrible, terrible phrasing there. And then the recent actions by our government up here in Canada, banning multiple styles of semi-automatic long gun, such as the Ruger Mini 14 and the AR-15, and that's caused quite a bit of consternation. Don't worry if you don't know all the details of it. That's not going to matter for this podcast. We're going to talk about how people are arguing these issues and how to make it better. So Americans listening, you don't have to know anything about Canadian politics. Canadians listening, you don't have to Google the sordid details of a sexual assault allegation. We're talking about the arguments surrounding it, the heuristics, as Chris Hayes is fond of saying, which is ironic because Chris Hayes is a collection of far left-wing shorthands, and it drives me crazy because the man is clearly very educated, clearly very, I guess, intellectual in his own way, but his shortcuts based on echo chamber certainty just drive me bonkers. Mouse, what are sort of your general thoughts on this issue? I know I have one thing that I know will get you talking, but I want to give you sort of an open starting point, because in critical thinking, we don't like to make assumptions, right?
Right. But right. Now you've got me curious. Don't do that to me. Tell me.
Okay. Well, I think the starting issue, the problem as to why we have all these highly educated people, obviously it is not one source, but a big one, is that before, the primary place where people were taught critical thinking skills was college. College is now remedial high school. And so those skills are not just not taught late, they are never taught.
Yes, that is an unfortunate side effect of the steady decline of American education.
Yeah.
High school is no longer high school.
Right.
When you compare it to, you know, when I spoke to my husband's father about the stuff that he saw in high school when he was attending versus the material that my husband saw, it is a drastic difference in standard in just academic levels, and when we're talking a mountain town, and of course my father studied electrical engineering, so my experience was of course not exactly analogous to his, because I have a degree in arts. However, when I spoke to my favorite teacher at college when I was doing my master's degree, she was the instructor of for crying out loud, why is the class?
Doesn't matter. Classical art, whatever.
Well, no. She this is when I was doing my master's in music.
Okay.
This was my methods in music research
teacher. Oh, it was a researching course. Okay.
And she told me that compared to the masters that we were doing, when she had to do her masters, and she had a doctorate by this point, the level of academic rigor had slipped dramatically, and she was not that much older. She was maybe at least 10 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of proved itself later in the class when we had two students in this class, in the methods of music research class, mm-hmm. at a master's level, I must remind
you. Okay, master's, critical point there.
Yeah. The two students raised a holy kerfuffle because this teacher had dared to assign us 3 books to read throughout the class.
Wait, the whole term?
The whole term.
And this was a music course?
Yes.
A research
class. Not only that, one of the people complaining had a prior bachelor's degree as an English and literature.
Okay, I took English literature. You were lucky if you got off with 15 books a course.
Mm-hmm.
I deliberately found courses where I could use a couple of books, the same, like I'd read it once and use it in multiple courses. Of course, that kind of backfires because you're reading it from different perspectives. However, what are you doing in a research and or language course if you complain about reading 3 books a term?
Exactly.
That's actually kind of scary to me.
And well, the sad thing is that this teacher eventually was taken off this course.
Yeah, that's because of the way they go.
Because of the complaints. And then eventually she just retired from teaching in academia altogether. And is now very successful. I think she's doing market research or something like
right,
that. But
right.
That just goes to show you, it's not just, what people say, oh, public school, high school, elementary. No, it's the whole system. Because once you had bureaucrats dictating what the academic pensum was going to be, mm-hmm. and and the only thing that bureaucrats understand is polls.
Yes. What's popular?
What's popular, and how well did we do numbers wise?
Right.
Not how well do we understand something?
Right.
Then when you basically create a system that is permeated by nothing, like by nothing but that.
Yeah.
As an educational system, you basically end up with nothing more than bureaucrats to be, which basically means people who do not exercise critical thinking.
That's right.
They are prone, that they're ready and willing and able to listen to orders or to listen to someone they consider their superior.
Right.
But that they're not going to exercise that critical thinking to go, no, you're full of shit.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's gotten bad. I mean, the other issue is that, let's face it, political discourse, which is intended to hijack critical thinking, it's not even persuading anymore, it's outright manipulation, mm-hmm. is setting the tone and the strategy, for lack of a better term, of all our discussions. We are so inundated with political media that it's infected everything. It's that idea, everything is political. Postmodern Frankfurt School theories have gotten in to the general discourse by way of places like University of Chicago and places like Harvard. And we've got a real mess that we have to untangle. It's starting to happen, but we are so far down the rabbit hole that, we need to give the whole thing a bit of a boost, a bit of a kick in the butt.
Yeah.
Because I'm seeing people, I mean, I posted a thing about, it was intended to be a joke, it was intended to be a bit self-effacing about my own political leanings, my own political bias, because I've been having this uncomfortable thing with COVID that our premier, Doug Ford, he likes to style himself as sort of a mini Trump style populist. Uh-huh. But with the COVID thing, eventually he started sounding and acting like a rational human being.
We knew that was not going to last long, did it?
Well, no. And so I put up a thing that was basically, okay, Doug Ford's being stupid again, I can relax. It was something of a joke. And I linked to an article about how he was making this ridiculous zero-sum straw man argument about how the gun control measures weren't going to work. They were a waste of money. They shouldn't do gun buybacks. You know, we should be increasing border security. We should be spending the money on border security, which one is a dog whistle. Mm. Two doesn't match the facts, and three is absurd and kind of ridiculous. So for people who are wondering, one, it's a dog whistle because the issue with border security isn't so much guns. More on that in a bit. Guns are part of it, but more on that in a bit. It's the irregular migration that has legitimately strained the resources and social services of Ontario and Quebec, because that's where the bulk of the people fleeing fear of deportation to their home countries. I shouldn't say home countries. They lived in America until recently. But one of the case studies was these gay men from Uganda. Mm-hmm. We're afraid of being sent back because that's one of the countries that, yeah, mm-hmm. their lives are at risk just yeah. for being gay in Uganda. And so they fled to Canada. And until their refugee hearings are processed, they're basically being paid to stay here. They're being put up in housing, and the provinces have to facilitate that. All right, yes, it's very difficult. We didn't create the problem. We're dealing with it as best we can, but that's not guns. And this was where I come to my second point. The guns that are the illegal guns on the street, only half of them are smuggled into the country from the US. Only half. A lot of people are under the false perception that most of the guns that Canadians use to commit crimes come from the US. That's not so anymore. They've actually gotten pretty good at the stuff going up from the U.S. They've gotten very good at detecting these very ingenious smuggling methods. But half the guns are either ghost guns, meaning they're built from legally obtainable components in 3D printers, so they're made whole cloth with no serial numbers, or straw purchases. Meaning the gun was originally obtained legally. It is then sold to someone for fair market price, who then attempts to file off the serial numbers and then flips it and sells it to criminals for 10 times the price. A handgun worth $200, $300 book value can go for $3,000 in Canada because they're hard to get. And so those straw purchases, those reselling, is what this particular law, this particular new set of regulations is intended to address. Because if the guns aren't around in the first place, then well, you're not gonna have to worry about these sales. But Doug Ford, you know, it's just a talking point. We best I can tell, and this is speculation, the big issue right now is in Nova Scotia. He's premier of Ontario, so he gets to say the conservative talking point. So federal conservatives who have to worry about getting reelected or elected for the first time in Nova Scotia don't wear it. But it was asinine. The idea that $600 million, which is the expected cost of the buyback program, could be better suited to, you know, beefing up security on a very, very long border, when you figure that, you know, it costs about $30 million to beef up one checkpoint. So imagine the length of the U.S.-Canada border, plus all the ports, plus all the, like, you know, narco subs and drones and all that stuff. Imagine the cost of trying to combat this issue that way. $600 million isn't even going to come close to cutting that. So it was an asinine statement, of course. Well, people didn't focus on that. Cue all the standard NRA talking points about turning gun owners, law-abiding gun owners, into criminals, even though there's a two-year amnesty period, and people who are using it for sustenance hunting, that means hunting for food, are exempt. because they're unlikely to sell the gun, right? Their livelihood depends on that gun. They're unlikely to resell it. That's why they're exempt. Indigenous people, same way, because they hunt as part of culture and so on and so forth. It's just recycled NRA talking points. But the funniest and the most egregious example of a complete lack of critical thinking is somebody posted a meme that were pictures of different models of the Ruger Mini 14 long gun line, rifle line. The Ruger Mini 14 is of particular significance up here in Canada because it was the gun used in the L'École Polytechnique shootings, which previous to the situation in Nova Scotia was our largest mass killing.
Mass killing.
Yeah. We're still only at like 24 people. That's our top. It was 18 before this, I believe. But so that gun's obviously had an emotional connection to it. But the meme was basically, what is the difference between these guns? And his trick question, they're all exactly the same gun. And I looked at this picture. It was a picture of 6 to 8 guns. On the one side, it was guns that were cosmetically more hunting style. So, you know, they had sort of the ergonomic but more wood look handle. The ones on the right looked more like military style weapons.
Uh-huh.
And a big talking point on pro gun contingents is that AR-15s are not N-16s. They are not technically assault weapons. They are semi-automatic. They don't have the full auto and burst fire options that the M16 does. This is fact. But the issue is the guns on the right very clearly had at least 20 round magazines attached to them, whereas the guns on the right
were single shot.
Five shot. Standard issue Ruger M14. The standard five-shot Ruger Mini 14 hunting rifle is not what people are using in spree shootings or mass shootings. They're using extended, you know, 30-round clips with pistol grip add-ons, which the one on the bottom right even had the pistol grip add-on, which is sort of useless to be using that gun the way it's intended to be used for hunting.
Yeah.
Because it throws, you can't shoulder stock it properly because of the way it shapes your hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's intended to, you know, allow you to spray fire at closer range.
Yeah. And unless you're getting swarmed by a horde of deer.
Right. Which unlikely. And if you're being swarmed by a horde of deer, under most circumstances, one loud boom causes them to scatter, which is mm-hmm. why the 20-shot magazines are really, really not useful for hunting. Because the whole thing about hunting is an ideal hunter, it's one shot, one kill, mm-hmm. right? Because after you've gone boom the first time,
they've scattered.
Yeah, your dinner's run away if you miss. Or you got to chase it because it's bleeding and it's really disgusting and you know, traumatic for everyone involved. It's not pretty. And so most hunters are like, if you need 20 rounds, learn to shoot better.
Yeah.
But the point of contention came down to the statement I pointed out was inaccurate. They are not exactly the same gun. In the same way, okay, you have two, say, Toyota Camrys, whatever, just random example. We're going to go back in the day. I remember when air conditioning was coming in with cars, and all of a sudden, ooh, cars had air conditioning. Well, if you had one Toyota Camry without air conditioning and another Toyota Camry with air conditioning, those are not exactly the same car, mm-hmm. correct? It's just like a Bartlett pair and an Anjou pair aren't the exact same kind of pair.
That's my car, actually.
The Camry? There you go.
Camry.
You know, there are many, many models of Camry and the price range on them. I mean, some of the high-end Camrys, the like luxury editions,
mm-hmm.
beautiful cars. but I used to sell Toyotas, so that's why I went for the Camry.
There you go.
It's the same thing with, well, I used to be the receptionist in a car dealership, I should clarify. I wasn't actually a salesperson, but I pointed out that no, just like cars with different features are not the same car, a five-shot Ruger Mini 14 is not the exact same gun as a 20-shot Ruger Mini 14. That should have been like, all right, fine, you're right. You know, that is just facts. But instead, what happened, they jumped to another talking point. And I had a very interesting conversation with some people on Twitter. I asked them, what would convince you to change your mind on something? And the number one most common answer was new facts. So we have two completely different types of people. We have people who will be persuaded by facts, provided they are able to trust the facts. And then we have people who, when presented with undeniable facts, just blank out. They blank out. One person on my comments called it Westworlding. Do you watch Westworld, Mouse?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, Westworld robots they're called hosts, and they have very specific scripts. Mm-hmm. And there are times, it's basically a call out to essentially the Turing test, that whenever a guest in the park, organic humans, says something that's not compatible with the host code, mm-hmm. the host is just unable to see it. So it just, they just go on about their day as if nothing's there. It's pretty much invisible to them. And so this user of mine, his screen name's Auron Darklord. He calls this process whereby people who don't know how to argue facts have been trained away from arguing based on facts when they're presented with this information that no, these exact same guns, for instance, are not the exact same guns, they Westworld. They just blank. They just revert to programming and carry on as if nothing contradictory was said. And I love that term because it gets to a central problem with getting people to think critically, you know?
Yes. That reminds me of something that Terry Pratchett wrote in many of his Discworld books about how willing people were to absolutely ignore something that was completely out of their experience.
Yes. Yeah.
And so that is, I have not read Mort in a very long time, so I don't remember if this is exactly how it works. But for example, when Mort became Death,
right?
He was invisible to just about everybody because they were not expecting to see him, and
right.
They did not expect to see, you know, an anthropomorphic personification of Death. And so, of course, if he were to be at a party and grab some hors d'oeuvres, for example, the waiter would notice that the hors d'oeuvres were missing, but then he would quickly rationalize it away and then not think about it anymore, because the implications of noticing him were far graver than
trying It changes the paradigm too much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad that Terry Pratchett's daughter has finally got a deal to produce loyal, proper
faithful Discworld adaptations
of Discworld, because unlike the sort of gloomy, very pedantic, very each individual member of a race is a perfect embodiment and example of the race stuff we get with Tolkien, because he just wanted to invent languages and deal with his wartime combat fatigue.
Yep.
Terry Pratchett is they're more like, and this is something of a generalization, but they're more like Aesop's fables in that they have these whimsical, very back to nature settings, but they're very much morality fables that deal with the mistakes people make in their thinking. I mean, I still maintain that Granny Weatherwax is Terry Pratchett's self-insert character. He'd say all the things he thinks but can't say in public through Granny Weatherwax, because she is one of the greatest critical thinkers in fiction.
Yes, we should ask Rihanna about that if she ever talked to her father about that. I'm sure she must have.
Yeah, I mean, for people who aren't familiar with Terry Pratchett but have played the Dragon Age games, Flemeth in,
yes.
in Dragon Age is very much an homage to Granny Weatherwax, as is, I believe, Kreia from the Old Republic games.
Yes.
The Old Republic games. It's a trope. There's a lot of Terry Pratchett in BioWare games. Because it's just so wonderful.
Yes.
But I would put Terry Pratchett into like high school curriculum to encourage kids to think critically through these, you know, sword and sorcery type stories that are relevant to their interests, because that's trendy now. The problem is that we have this issue in schools now. I don't know if you saw that Alaska banned a bunch of books, including The Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
And a Maya Angelou book, because it's basically thought crimes. You can go out into a bookstore and buy these books, but oh God, we don't want them in school libraries because it's just too hard for teachers to contextualize challenging material for students. I swear to God, that was the justification for banning these books. So not only are parents shouldn't be teachers now, but teachers
shouldn't be
can't
teachers.
Be expected to be teachers.
And that's what happens when you put bureaucrats in charge of education.
Yeah, I mean, we cannot fix the issues facing our society right now if we don't first educate populations to be able to solve any problem, never mind the most difficult, complex problems of our age, right?
Well, here's the thing. The problem with government, as government has become, it has become this overarching bit of a nanny state in many cases. And even though I'm quite sure there's a lot of people who extended these regulations with the best of intentions, the outcome of many, many of these is that you're essentially impeding the actual experts and professionals who have knowledge, expertise, and weight in their field from doing their jobs. And instead, you put a gigantic number of middle management who handled the teachers or any other expert in their field as if they were a second-rate star about to play an opening number for a much bigger number. And so it's basically, well, you can't do this, you can't do that, you should not do this, this is not good optics, you can't do this, this might be problematic. And so you end up basically with this minefield of regulations that make it so that in the end, you'll have a small core of dedicated people in their field, in this case, teachers, who
right.
stick it out because they're truly devoted to their cause and to teaching the students. But you will have a large number of people who just do not have the stamina to deal with all that bullshit, who drop out, and you end up also with a somewhat large contingent of people who are there because they know they can game the system.
Right.
That they can gain potential long-term employment with very difficult dismissal.
Right.
And eventually they learn the system to just game it and do whatever the heck they want because they know they can't be fired.
Yeah. My personal experiences back you up on that. During the 1990s, the late 1990s, when a conservative government, of course, the Mike Harris government in Ontario, attempted back to basics educational reforms with god-awful standardized testing. And basically the standardized test was any creativity in language is wrong. Also ongoing strikes. So every 3 years there were strikes. I had excellent, excellent teachers in high school. I was very lucky. A lot of those really great teachers left high school teaching to take university positions because they had master's degrees and PhDs and had been it had been lured away from hardcore academia in the late 60s and 70s to teach high school, because back then we wanted good teachers who were able to teach. And I asked one of them who was like, you know, I was still in touch with, and he said, I didn't get into this to walk a picket line. He wanted to be able to go somewhere where he could actually teach.
Teach.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, on a hardcore critical thinking analysis, what happened in education was, instead of educational curriculums being based on best evidence and facts interpreted by people qualified to effectively present and interpret those facts, instead, educational decisions, curriculum decisions are being made by political appointees using an appeal to authority fallacy argument. Uh-huh. Put this in a really simple example that people can understand. Instead of, you know, people who have spent their lives researching this stuff, Trump just appoints Betsy DeVos. So now she's the education, I almost called her the education minister, secretaries down there, right? Education secretary. Yes, sorry, Canadian term.
I just had this mental image of her as what's her face?
Like the church lady from Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
Yeah, yes, minister from the British show. But yeah, so Betsy DeVos, okay, you're education secretary. And now everything she says is treated as fact just simply because of her title. That mm-hmm. isn't the same. That is the difference between an educated fact-based position and a fallacious appeal to authority.
Yeah.
And it's similar with some of these other issues. I mean, with the long gun stuff, it's just everything is fallacious. They use goalpost moving and straw man arguments. They use this zero sum fallacy, where if a policy does not solve the entire problem, it's worthless. And that fallacious argument can be used to gut any measure, any gun control measure, certainly, because there are different types of gun crime, and different types of gun crime are solved in different ways. You know, urban crime, which is heavily driven by gang activity and predominantly uses handguns and knives and stuff like that. Well, that's one solution. I'm talking about Canada. Mm-hmm. Rural intimate partner violence that escalates to firearm attempted murder or murder, that's a totally different issue. And those killings can be cut down if the police are able to know there is a long gun in the home and when domestic violence is committed. They used to be able to go in and take the guns because they had the beginnings of a long gun registry. So they know who had them, and they get a domestic violence call. That's it. The guns are gone. They're seized because they want to stop guys from killing their wives or girlfriends because they got drunk and angry, right? Happened to have a loaded rifle in the house. These are very, very different issues. And so no single piece of legislation is going to solve all of it. The mark of a good piece of legislation is not that it solves the whole problem. It's that it improves the problem. And that's the frustrating part of being a legislator. To get elected, you have to go in and promise to solve problems. You can't in 4 years. You can only make things better for people. And that's not exciting, because we've been trained, right? We've been trained to want the hero's rescue, not an administrator's amelioration. You know, alliteration aside, I made it sound pretty, but you know, a 40% reduction in gun homicides doesn't sound as exciting as I solved the problem, right?
Yeah.
And, but I mean, hey, any policy that got a 40% reduction in anything, that would be seen as a huge success for about 2 years before somebody starts going after that program as unnecessary. I've seen that in youth social work all the time. That I had a friend, he's a youth pastor. He went into a community. They said, your two things are get down the teenage pregnancy, and get down the vandalism. And very, very quickly, both of those issues dropped significantly just by diverting the kids' activities. Really, really simple things we know work. And so within only a few years of this rapid reduction in what used to be called juvenile delinquency, they start going, well, the numbers are fine now. Maybe we don't need these programs. They completely invert cause and effect. And this is the issue that, yeah, no, you're laughing because if you don't laugh, you cry, right?
It's exactly the same thing as well. You know, the curve is flattening, so we don't need lockdown anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. It's the chicken and the egg fallacy, right? Mm-hmm. That is an easy either or, as opposed to the issue being interconnected and complex.
It's what, oh, take a shot. It's what Ayn Rand called the primacy of consciousness.
Elaborate on that.
So in her philosophy, it's the primacy of existence. Existence comes first. Observable fact, observable reality trumps any interpretation of it.
Right.
The person who is correct, the person who is right, is the one who manages to identify facts that are the closest to and the most faithful to what is actually going on in reality. As opposed to the sun rises every morning, so therefore the sun must orbit around the earth. Versus no, the earth orbits around the sun. It is merely this is the reason why it looks like it's rising. Mm-hmm. So in this case, it's basically this is what is versus this is what we wanted. This is what we desperately wish it were.
Right. If people don't know, that is what the church argued for years and years and years, that the sun rose and the moon rose because the earth was static, because the earth was the center of the universe.
The universe, the geocentric model.
Yeah. And it got to the point, I mean, if you want to look up Tycho Brahe's model of the universe, it is absurd and insane and hilarious, and he knew it was, but he was...
He had to.
He was such a politician. He was such a butt kisser, because he liked the lifestyle.
He liked the lifestyle, and he got his nose sliced off in a duel about a mathematical equation, and he wore a gold nose for the rest of his life.
Yeah, and
it was kind of crazy and kooky.
Well, he was a huge egomaniac.
Yes,
but he knew how to play the game, and that's the problem. Is if we don't have engaged critical thinking, then by the population, not just experts, not just people making these decisions, but by the population, then we end up with people in power who have a vested interest in short-circuiting reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going on right now.
And here's the thing, the reason I brought that particular fallacy is because what happens in these cases is that some people will deal with uncomfortable facts until the problem seems to be going away, at which point they go, well, they sort of create this mental gymnastics whereby they essentially go, oh, well, no, we really didn't need to do that, but thank you so much for your service. But now we can just go back to doing things the way we used to do, even though doing the things the way we used to do is what brought around the problem in the first place.
Right.
Because we want this to be the reality. We want to be able to have our cake and eat it too without having to do all of that uncomfortable thinking part.
Yeah, I mean, we say all the time that certainty is the enemy of reason, right? Like, in order to become a good critical thinker, you have to just break up with certainty. You have to become more comfortable with uncertainty.
Yeah, the thing is this, you can't, it. The way I see it is, certainty is possible. Because if certainty were not possible, then many would say that the quest for knowledge is in and of itself a fool's gambit.
But yes, not fair so. Point.
The problem is this, there is certainty and then there is the illusion of certainty.
Right.
we can be certain, and this is a very, very tricky thing, because once you are certain about something and you are proven to be right in that, you start making a habit of believing yourself to be always right,
right,
or to be always capable of finding that right answer right away.
Right.
Which is issues that, for example, I've seen with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, yes.
That we
Christopher Hitchens.
Christopher Hitchens.
Richard Dawkins. Bill Nye's done okay.
Yeah, there's some
more of an advocate than a hardcore scientist these days. But yeah.
But there's some cases when I go, really, Bill, you should have thought about that a little bit longer. But
even somebody in the social sciences from Bell Hooks, who started with some really, really, really brilliant observations that, like you said, fit the facts better than other theories of the time. And then she just started smelling her own farts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was that uncomfortable moment where she went after Beyonce for like, I believe it was her Lemonade project, and other people in a similar field who grew up, you know, respecting the hell out of Bell Hooks, had to go, Auntie Bell, no, you know, you're wrong. And it was well handled. But it was nice to see that coming of age in Black feminism. I very much enjoyed that moment. Now, it was brief and things got subsequently stupid with some of the other things. But yeah, you're right.
It's a bit of a drug.
Feeling.
Here's the thing. Realizing that you have a brain that can understand, that has a potential of understanding some of the secrets of the universe, or just yourself, and when you've stumbled upon, when you actually manage to get some questions, some answers right to the right questions, you start feeling a little bit like a teenager over again. You feel kind of invincible. You're going, aha, I am an intellectual giant. Pose me any questions and I shall give you the answer. And then, of course, when you have echo chambers, when you have a large fan following, when you have people who are constantly telling you what a genius you are, you can sort of get lax about your own intellectual rigor. You have to strive for certainty, but you have to constantly smash that certainty against any potential uncertainty to test your theory.
You know, I don't think you could have set up the Joe Biden situation better if you tried. That was an excellent segue in, because that's what's going on, right? A bunch mm-hmm. of people who have made their bona fides with believe women, you know, the time's up, me too, all this stuff, are really struggling right now because their platforms, their processes, were not based on sound things that would hold up even when the minority outcome occurs. That was a very wordy way of saying, you know, somebody like Kirsten Gillibrand, who screamed for Al Franken's head after one tasteless photograph emerged from years before he was a senator, now, no, I support Joe Biden. And people are rightly calling hypocrisy on that stuff, but it's going too far. And I wanted to talk about this situation because I think that the whole Me Too thing is a very important moment of social change. But because of its importance is why we desperately need critical thinking on this matter. And so far, we haven't gotten it.
Agreed.
Yeah. And it's because you had to be able to put the rhetoric in a hashtag, right? It's been hashtag activism from the first time. Well, I mean, okay, Tarana Burke started the whole thing, but it was Alyssa Milano that popularized the hashtag Me Too on Twitter. Right. Yeah. And everything had to be summed up in 240 characters and everything got very reductive, but everybody just blanketed themselves in comforting certainty. right? Mm-hmm. And people who are victims of trauma, certainty on some things is extremely important to recovery, because the core of trauma is not necessarily violence. It's not necessarily, you know, horror. It's a feel like you no longer have control over your life or your bodily autonomy or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so from a human level, I completely understand why people want certainty. But the whole idea of Me Too totally changed from its original intent. The whole idea of Believe Women totally changed from its original intent. And because there was so much scope creep, because the goalposts moved so much, the initial very, very good, very, very solid ideas are now being discredited because of people misapplying them. And that disturbs me.
The problem with that, when you try to reduce an intellectual principle to a hashtag, is that it's kind of like, this is gonna sound so strange, but let's say that I draw a very high quality, high resolution image.
Right.
And the file is enormous.
Right.
And Twitter tells me, well, no, you can't upload this because this, oh my God, what the heck have you been drawing? This is 4 gigabytes. What is wrong with you?
Right, right. Make it smaller.
So I'm going to make it smaller and smaller and smaller. The details start fading.
Right.
They start becoming indistinct, harder to make out. And let's say I want to make it my user icon. I had to make that tiny, tiny, tiny so everybody can see it.
Right.
Well, what happens then when you get that user icon and you want to go, oh, I want to see what exactly the detail is in this. I'm just going to go ahead and use Photoshop to blow it up.
Yeah, the detail's gone.
The detail is gone. And it's nothing more than artifact. And that's what happens when you try to encapsulate a position, an intellectual position, such as... You should take accusations of sexual assault seriously. You do not believe it on faith.
Right.
But you take the accusation seriously and you investigate.
Yeah. People, because sort of the concept, because many of the people involved in these issues were born mid-1990s or even born after the year 2000, hence the term millennial, they weren't around to see the bad old days when the minute a woman said she'd been assaulted, said she'd been raped, she was immediately dismissed. People didn't care. No, that really happened. So I think it's important to go back and deal with sort of the history of where the whole Believe Women thing got started, because it wasn't so long ago that women, it wasn't that, you know, things were investigated and then, oh no, found some reason to discredit a woman. No, accusations of sexual assault were just dismissed, mm-hmm. Out of hand. There was no investigation done. It was considered something that the woman's family or immediate community had to deal with, often by marrying her off to someone who would take care of her, even though she was quote unquote damaged goods. It wasn't seen as a problem for larger society. And that was where the Believe Women mantra, the Believe Survivors mantra came from. It was actually, it's interesting because Joe Biden, of all people, had a really good quote about what that mantra means that he's now being criticized for because of his current circumstance. But what do you think? Should we examine Joe Biden's statement, which are the ones he's being attacked for what he said during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Okay, so this is what Joe Biden said in 2018. About the Christine Blasey Ford accusations going back to 1982. Okay. Biden said, for a woman to come forward in the glaring lights of focus nationally, you've got to start off with the presumption that at least the essence of what she's talking about is real, whether or not she forgets facts, whether or not it's been made worse or better over time. But nobody fails to understand that this is like jumping into a cauldron. That's what he said. Now, this is the thing that he's being attacked for now and saying, well, that means you're automatically guilty. Mouse, what do you think about this assertion that Joe Biden has hung himself with his own words?
I don't really see it.
I don't either, because, and I wonder if you come at it the same way I do. The critical line in what Biden said, and oh my God, I'm actually rewarding Biden for precision of speech. This is the thing about critical thinking. It really challenges your assumptions. I never thought I'd be saying this about Joe Biden. But it's the part you've got to start off with the presumption that at least the essence of what she's talking about is real. Mm-hmm. That means you start off with this presumption or hypothesis and you test that presumption. You try to see if that holds, you know?
Yes.
And that actually holds in the Tara Reid case to an extent. My opinion is that part that she keeps talking about, even though it's very strange, she's very focused on the part of the whole claim that she was told to serve drinks at a party because somebody said Biden liked her legs and found her attractive. I think that 100% happened. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the essence of what she's talking about, that she felt mistreated, that she was made to feel ashamed and cheap by someone in Joe Biden's Senate staff invoking Joe Biden's name. Uh-huh. I believe that that essence of her complaint is real. Now, unfortunately, I believe that for various reasons, she didn't feel like she was being taken seriously about that part, which, let's face it, in 1992, 1993, she probably wasn't taken seriously by that element of the complaint. It's like, big deal, nobody put a hand on you, sort of thing. Right. And she got so traumatized by being dismissed that the story's grown and grown and grown. That theory is consistent with the facts, but also Joe Biden's statement about Kavanaugh. I mean, we do not have the situation with Tara Reid that, like Christine Blasey Ford, Tara Reid has not taken a polygraph test that was examined by three separate independent experts. We don't have that, you know?
Right.
We don't have documented counseling records from before. In Christine Blasey Ford's case, before Brett Kavanaugh ascended to a very high ranking for life appointment, you know, before that, she told her husband and a counselor in a counseling session that this happened. With Tara Reid, we have her making not just different statements, not just incomplete statements, but statements that actively contradict each other. And in critical thinking, when you start getting contradictions, then you've got a problem, right? Mm-hmm. And the core to it is this. Let's throw out all the Russia connections. That's noise. Let's throw out the passage in the book her father wrote that's very similar to the accusation she claimed. That is information that could show where this additional stuff came from, if it is in fact manufactured. But let's look at the core of the complaint, right? When a whole bunch of women came forward to accuse Joe Biden of creepy behavior, you know, Lucy Flores and company, which Joe Biden essentially admitted to and said he had to do better. Tara Reid's story was basically that she was made to feel uncomfortable At the time, she said she did not feel that the attentions were sexual. She said, and the word she used was, it was more ornamental. Mm-hmm. Now, ornamental is a very specific word.
Yes.
And this is when we have to ask ourselves, would someone who was suddenly and violently assaulted and then retaliated against, would it enter into their head to see the attentions of the guy who allegedly did it as not sexual and ornamental?
It is very unlikely.
Yes. And this is one of the issues I have, because it's one thing for someone to forget a detail. It's one thing for someone to not offer a piece of information because they're too scared and they're not ready to talk about it. All that's plausible.
Mm-hmm.
It's not plausible that someone would claim that they didn't see they didn't retroactively see the attentions of a man as not sexual if he slammed her against a wall and shoved his hand up her skirt.
Right.
That just defies credulity. And so what we have now is an outright contradiction. We don't have an incomplete story. We have a changed story. That in critical thinking is usually when we start going, I'm not so sure about this, right?
Yes. It's at the point where the story starts changing in such a way, especially with a psychological background, that you have to ask, what else is at play?
Well, at this point, now you're getting into, someone has an argument. Someone can say that that's not just misremembering. That is overtly deceptive.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you are unable to determine whether she was being deceptive then or whether she's being deceptive now. And at that point, you have to start giving Joe Biden benefit of the doubt. Now, notice I did not say he didn't do it or mm-hmm. she's lying.
Right.
I am saying that at that point, that is when we maintain that the presumption of the essence of what she's saying is real, because that serving drinks thing very likely did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And shame on everyone in that office for letting that go on. Now, some, she claims, fought like, no, you don't have to do this. Some of them said that at the time. So it was a big to-do in the office. That happened. So we can be consistent with Joe Biden's past statements, but we can also say, like, look, at this point, when she starts actively contradicting herself, we can no longer say that, we can no longer presume that things happened exactly the way she claimed.
Yes, that's the problem with when you essentially turn yourself into an unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm. And that's different than the details that Christine Blasey Ford couldn't recall or was a little bit shaky on or had to clarify later. Those were things like, where exactly was the house? Well, it was so many years ago. The exact address of the house was not relevant to the immediate assault. Mm-hmm. So she wouldn't remember that. You know, she might remember details of the particular room. She might very likely would not remember the layout of the entire house, why it wasn't relevant to the attack, right?
Right.
The other thing I find strange about this whole hypocrisy thing, memories are very short. The issue in the Kavanaugh hearing was not, he did it, kick him out, you know, withdraw the nomination. The issue in the Kavanaugh hearing was that it was a rushed confirmation process with inadequate time to properly investigate the claims.
Mm-hmm.
In this instance, it's 6 months until the election. There will be plenty of time to investigate these claims.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not, you know, Mitch McConnell or Nancy Pelosi can't ram the election through, like, hurry up, we're going to do the vote in June, right? That's right. Not going to happen. We're not dealing with the same set of circumstances. The outrage over the Kavanaugh hearing was the fact that the Republicans party at large, but especially Mitch McConnell, didn't really seem interested in finding out whether this happened or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's a completely different paradigm. So, you know, there we go. It's not apples to apples. We can say, I don't think the Kavanaugh hearing was right. I don't like the way it went down. My position at the time, for the record, was I was not completely persuaded one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Like, if I was on a jury based on the information I had, I'm not sure I could make a decision, precisely because it was rushed, right?
Yeah.
I was convinced, I was persuaded, based on his demeanor at the hearing, that he did not have the appropriate temperament for the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah. Of that, I definitely agree.
Yeah, and that was the question that needed to be answered at the time. Did I think the guy should be confirmed to the Supreme Court? Not should he go to jail, you know, not should he be kicked off the existing bench, whether this guy was going to be one of the final words on legal precedent. I don't think he met that bar. The U.S. Senate disagreed, but that's the only decision I had to make regarding the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, right?
Yep.
That is a different question than whether you think someone is qualified to be president, which is a limited term with limited powers, right? Mm-hmm. Granted, Supreme Court justices have limited powers too, but it's a job for life.
Yeah.
And I mean, the question at the time was, do we want two guys on the Supreme Court at the same time with this sort of asterisk next to their name? Because Clarence Thomas is still there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the makeup of the court, all that stuff matters. With the presidency, the question is a little different. Because again, we're talking about something that may or may not have happened in 1993. Joe Biden has already admitted that his behavior was at best profoundly out of date, and he needed to be more aware of how he was making people uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah. So that's settled. And the fact that even fairly respectable newspapers are saying, you know, oh, certain elements of her account have been confirmed by friends. Well, that's not the dispute here. Even mm-hmm. Joe Biden doesn't deny that he did some things that retroactively are not appropriate. You know,
right.
You can't go smelling women's hair and rubbing women's shoulders anymore. That was considered by some in the 70s to be charming worm behavior. Not everywhere, but by nope. some. Guys mm-hmm. thought that was charming, right? It was never as charming as guys thought it was. But it was certainly considered much more acceptable behavior, even in the 1990s. Than it is in 2020. Social norms have changed significantly. That's not up for debate. The question is, did he outright sexually assault the woman? We have this issue of the witnesses corroborating, you know, contemporaneous corroboration, this thing people use to see if somebody's telling the truth. And they found a neighbor who she told he assaulted her 2 years after the fact, after she'd already told her mother, and her mother freaked out, which any mother would.
Right.
But a thing that's very telling to me is when the New York Times originally investigated the claims, the people she said would confirm her story didn't. You know, people had to go and find a neighbor somewhere, but the people she thought would back her up didn't. Those were her witnesses. And other than this one neighbor, nobody else is confirming except her brother, which, come on, he's her brother. What's he gonna say? But nobody else confirms the specific details that she's telling now. And her theory that, oh, I was afraid to say it all because of backlash, because I'm being threatened because of all this, that doesn't play the same way with trusted confidants that you think have your back, right? So why is the story so inconsistent? But now I'm being politically incorrect, right? This is what bothers me about the whole thing, right? Because what we're talking about is a crime. And it's a difficult to prove crime in a lot of cases, because the definition of sexual assault has rightly changed over the years. And so coercion can look practically indistinguishable from consensual sex in terms of physical evidence, right?
Right.
In a lot of cases, it's a preponderance of evidence ruling, not criminally. Criminally is beyond reasonable doubt. But a lot of these issues happen in either court of public opinion or at on a university campus or in a workplace, right? Where the metric, the baseline is preponderance of evidence, not beyond reasonable doubt. That's how that is the paradigm upon which people are going to decide the election, right? Preponderance of evidence. And people are very emotional about this. And this goes back to, I keep thinking about what we discussed in previous podcasts about not wanting to vote for the lesser of evils.
Right.
I understand why people are upset, you know, because I think they were really hoping for a Democratic primary where some white knight, you know, morally pure savior was going to rise that made it easy for them to vote with a totally clean conscience instead of just an anti-Trump vote. That was unlikely to happen, you know? And now we get into this very messy reality of, and this is where very complex critical thinking comes into play again, just like I talked about the last Canadian election. It was a shit show. But it becomes a question of, okay, we have paradigm one. I want to vote for active good. I don't just want to vote for the lesser of evils, right? Then we have the other thing of, we're probably never going to know with certainty what happened here. And so people are left in the very difficult situation of, I don't know if I want to choose between one guy, Joe Biden, who's been accused of sexual assault one time, versus Donald Trump, who has been accused of sexual assault 12 to 25 times, depending on the metric you set, right?
Right.
That understandably makes people feel really grossed out. And this is where the tactical argument comes in. Of voter suppression is going to be one tool in Trump's toolbox this time around. Voter suppression is how he won last time. It's how if he wins again, he's going to win this time. I mean, there was a lot of voter suppression on a lot of levels in 2016. But one major tactic of voter suppression or voter disenfranchisement or voter apathy was what's now been summed up in the meme, but her emails, the false equivalency created in the media. And so people, and this is a very valid motivation when you go to vote, people are like, I don't like either of them. So I'm going to vote third party or I'm not going to vote at all. Now, of course, some people who voted third party did that as a protest vote, which I've pointed out to a few people, and they get very upset at me. If you're not actively voting for a third party candidate, that you actually support,
believe in,
mm-hmm. yeah, then you are still taking a lesser of evils approach, and you might as well just vote for the Democrat or the Republican. It's different for people who legitimately want the Libertarian ticket to be on the ballot, and so they vote for third party, try to get it above that threshold.
Right, like right now, Justin Amash has announced that he is going to run for president. And I, you know, looking at his record, considering that he opposed Trump from day one, and he left the Freedom Caucus because he said that it was no longer the Freedom Caucus.
Yeah.
You know, I do think that third party voters would look at him and vote for him, go, you know, knowing not, it's not just a vote against Trump, but because the man does have principles that he sticks by.
Yeah, it's giving more moderate to right-leaning voters. So Joe Biden's moderate bona fides, I think, are undeniable, but his party's going to push him more to the left. But mm-hmm. who are right-leaning, who don't consider Trump a conservative or don't like the way the Republican Party's going, yeah, Justin Amash, his the moral courage narrative is definitely compelling, you know? Similar to Gary Johnson had a lot of interesting things going for him last time around. He had that incredibly unfortunate high-profile gaffe moment that mm-hmm. a lot of people saw that when they didn't see anything else about him. That is the difficulty in running in a third-party candidacy. But Gary Johnson... I mean, then you had
Donald Trump, who couldn't name the exact number of amendments to the Constitution, and somehow he got elected.
Well, the reason he got elected is because people are just like, I'm voting Republican.
Yeah.
I don't care. He's the leader of the Republican Party now. I'm voting Republican. That was the base. Those people are going to vote for him again. Some people were swayed by that he's a businessman. Some people just hated Hillary Clinton. But then there were those, you know, 15,000, 50,000, 40,000 voters who voted for Jill Stein in places like Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And Jill Stein has some very major asterisks in her column as well. Like, I get why people voted for Gary Johnson. The Jill Stein thing, I'm sorry. There is no plausible theory of I don't want to vote for the lesser of evils that justifies a vote for Jill Stein. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Well, she was going for the homeopathic victory.
aided by pictures of her seated next to Putin. Yeah. Well, I mean, and this is the problem, right? This is when we get into perspective and critical thinking. And this is when critical thinking becomes very hard. Because if the perfect candidate was presented to us, voting would be easy, right?
Yeah.
Too many people think that you cannot engage in affirmative voting if you're not voting for someone you totally agree with and you see as morally beyond reproach. We do not live in an age where that choice exists. You've got to find something to vote for in an age where everyone is imperfect, and with technology and with the political nastiness that goes on at that level, you are going to have to vote for any candidate, warts and all.
Uh-huh.
You know, every bad thing a person did and some things they didn't do, you know, are going to be on full display. Politics is ugly, and political media is not very good at separating the credible, the legitimate criticisms from political muckraking.
No.
Because for whatever reason, something changed in the media. And I'm not exactly sure when it did. Because when I started, I used to work on a political talk radio station. I've worked in you know, music documentary and music news. I've also obviously been a video game journalist. When I started, you didn't just report, this person said this, this person said that. That's what they do now, because that's fair and balanced, right?
Right.
Back in the day, it used to be this person, person A said this, person B said this. Now, what do the objective facts say? What can I dig? What can I find to support one of the other position or both positions, or, you know, detract from one position or the other position? What is additional information that I can provide the reader as well? That additional information no longer happens when the story breaks, because it's not required. The bar is set so low.
The bar is set so low because the obligation to churn out a constant stream of news and information has increased.
Well, it's there also, sorry, go ahead.
There is, you know, there is no time. And also the longer you spend on one story, I'll put it like this. The longer that you spend on one story, and delving into it and doing such boring and unsexy things as objective fact verification, the higher the chances that you have of an audience drop-off. Because
you're right. And you know what? I really give Rachel Maddow credit for threading that needle. And people are like, oh, Rachel Maddow, she's so left-wing. Hear me out, okay? Yes, Rachel Maddow is incredibly left-wing. Rachel Maddow has her biases. Rachel Maddow sometimes drops the ball. But she's not Chris Hayes, okay? Chris Hayes, most of... The thing that frustrates me so much about Chris Hayes is the minute he announces a topic, that's all he has to do. I know exactly what he's going to say. He never says anything unexpected or interesting. Whereas Rachel Maddow does a very interesting thing on her show. She leverages her personal popularity. So, like, I will turn it on to watch Rachel Maddow because I think she is adorable. But she will start with the headline screaming Trump stupid of the day. But her and her producers are very good with going, okay, now we're going to give you as sort of like a palate cleanser between the screaming headline of the day one and the screaming headline of the day two. When Fox News would jump to a veterans, animals, or moms and kids story as a palate cleanser, Rachel Maddow jumps to a story that she describes it as, I think this might be potentially important going forward. And the most recent one she did was they covered a video that was taken inside a prison. I believe it was in North Carolina, but I might be wrong, where the inmates were rioting because they were afraid of COVID-19, or as they say down there, the coronavirus, more often than not. They just showed the video. And basically, her tagline is, watch this space. Earlier this week. It doesn't matter because people are listening at this at different times. But she followed up on that story that they'd already stuck a pin in and said, all right, this story turned out to be important because after that riot and after two prisoners died, they mass tested the prison. 900 cases of coronavirus in that one prison, including 75 guards. So not inmates, employees.
Yep.
900 cases. And so that is good journalism. And I can say Rachel Maddow has a very, very extreme left-wing bias. And I can say Rachel Maddow is an excellent TV journalist, and these two things are not in conflict.
Right.
You know, you can rely on her to have a very left-wing bias. You can also, and that involves the story she's interested in, the story she covers, the way the stories are covered, the particular angle she covers them in. But within that left-wing bias framework, you can usually rely on the accuracy of the facts she presents. That's important.
Yes, it is.
The segment that Chris Hayes did on Joe Biden contained no new facts. It was entirely opinion And ironically, because Chris Hayes drops the word heuristics all the time, it was completely a heuristic argument. For people who don't know what a heuristic is, I'm going to butcher this, but it's basically a shorthand that people use to come to decisions quickly. Did I get that right?
Yes, it's okay. Basically an approach to problem solving that employs practical methods that are not guaranteed to be optimal, but which they're considered sufficient to solve an immediate short-term goal.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought Chris Hayes was solving an immediate short-term goal by covering his liberal progressive ass, right? His yeah. White male liberal progressive ass. Straight cisgendered, I should add, that gives him increased vulnerability in this moment. He didn't say anything enlightening. He simply repeated the truism that no matter what her politics, no matter what she said about Putin, no matter who Tara Reid supported, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, all that stuff, mm-hmm. You can't just ignore her accusations. I don't know of anybody who watches MSNBC who is just ignoring her accusations.
Yeah.
Not finding her credible is not the same as ignoring her accusations. Not finding her credible means you gave her a chance, you looked into it, something about it didn't sit right to you. And that's a valid perspective, the same way it was valid in the case of Amber Heard, the same way it was valid in the case of, you know, they couldn't go after Harvey Weinstein until they had like 9 women willing to come forward. Like, come on.
Yeah.
You know, the whole Harvey Weinstein situation was so gross because it was allowed to go on for so long, you know? And I found that whole kerfuffle with hashtag fire Chris Hayes. I found that ridiculous. I found his statements. Did you follow this at all? Did you see this at all?
Yes.
The whole, oh, he should be fired because he's helping Trump?
Yeah.
I mean, on the one hand, I can see why viewers of Chris Hayes would be upset. Because let's face it, they don't tune in to Chris Hayes for nuanced opinion. They tune in to Chris Hayes so he can dunk on Trump for an hour 5 days a week, right?
Right, it's for people who don't want to sit and they watch the Colbert Report or what is his show now?
Oh, the Tonight Show, Letterman's old spot.
The Late Show.
The Late Show, yes. That's why I just say the names of the hosts. I can't remember the names because they're all so generic.
Well, it's in my mind, he's always doing the Colbert Report.
Exactly.
So I always forget.
He tried not to do it, and then it was like, nah, go back to what works.
Nah, yeah.
Right? But it's interesting because I thought the original story, all right, dude, it's your show. I was not surprised at all at the position Chris Hayes took. I think that Chris Hayes was being Chris Hayes. He said the textbook correct, extreme left, you know, not only economically left, but socially progressive left, PC talking point of we must believe women. Anybody who expected anything else to come out of Chris Hayes hasn't been paying attention, mm-hmm. right? So the segment was a waste of time, but I find anything but Chris Hayes live audience content complete waste of time. They enlighten me not at all.
Right.
But then his response to the dust up, the blow up, which unlike Chuck Todd, he just ignores most of it and makes snarky little comments because obviously they wound him more than he's letting on. But the response that Chris Hayes gave was so unhelpful and such an example of really, really, I don't want to use the wrong adjective here, but it calls to me attention why we need to be really, really, really careful thinking critically about people who share, you know, a lot of agreement in terms of political affiliation. Because he said, you know, they love to make things derivative and sort things into categories, which is an easy way to explain something, but somewhat reductive. I do it too. It's a heuristic.
Right.
But he said that he was, as background, he was the first primetime host on the network to address the allegations. That surprised me. I guess they did it during the day on MSNBC. It all kind of runs together because I remember seeing that story on MSNBC. Maybe it was Chris Hayes' show because I watch his show about once a week to drive myself crazy. because, again, you have to not just watch people you totally agree with.
Right.
He lumped the complaints into three categories. He said the first category were people who basically said, I don't believe Tara Reid, I believe Joe Biden. He said the second group of critics were the I don't care category, saying it consisted of Democrats who see unseating President Trump as an urgent priority. And then the third category, and you can practically hear him saying this in his voice. And then the third category, which I got a lot of, that was the most disquieting to me. You see the sort of lead up?
Uh-huh.
A whole lot of people pointing to various aspects of Reed's character or her writings or her politics as a kind of proof that she's not credible. She's making it up. How is that different than category one?
Yeah, that's creating a false category.
It's a straw man. It's a classic straw man because the first category he summarized were people saying, I don't believe Tara Reid, I believe Joe Biden. You know what? People are allowed to make that determination. They are allowed to come up with their own opinions on whether it's two men, whether it's two women, whether it's a man and a woman, whether it's people who are gender nonconforming. You know, people are allowed to go, I believe this person, I don't believe this person.
Right.
The only difference between the first category, which is I don't believe Tara Reid, I believe Joe Biden, and the third category was that the third category gave reasons that they didn't believe her. That's the only difference.
That's the only difference.
See, I find the second category, the I don't care category, the most disturbing.
Yeah.
Because, and you know, it's the most disturbing because they're the only category that did exactly what we all lecture people, you shouldn't do. You shouldn't dismiss these accusations. You should care. That's the only group that wasn't doing any work, right?
Right.
This is inconvenient to me. I don't care. That's the wrong answer. That is more disturbing than people basing their core opinion on information that is ultimately irrelevant. You can reason with someone who's bothering to put in that time and get informed. It may be different. It may be difficult, but there's a starting point there. You know? It is relevant if someone does have motivation to lie about something terrible. It's not proof they're lying, but it is information that's of secondary or tertiary importance, right?
Right.
I do think it's fair when people go, I am immediately suspicious of anybody who's praised Vladimir Putin in the past, which was the position of Richard Painter, formerly a Republican. He was the ethics czar for George W. Bush. So this is not somebody with a deep, long-lasting love for the Democratic Party, right?
Right.
He is somebody who is deeply concerned about Russian meddling, has reason to believe that Russia has been after Biden as a credible threat to Trump for a while, and he wouldn't put it past them. I'm not saying I agree with his logic. In fact, I don't agree with his logic. I think there's better arguments against Reid's accusations. But I see where he's coming from.
Yeah.
Fine. Right?
Right.
And then Chris Hayes go on. He said people pointed exactly what I said, Reid's political positions. Other people pointed out that she praised Biden in the past, which that happens when people are trying to just pretend it never happened. All right, fine.
Yeah.
But this is what he said that I'm like, will men please shut up about women's issues in this regard? And yes, I am aware that is a generalization to the point that it is probably fallacious to a degree. It's an emotional response.
Right.
Hear me out though, guys. I'm going to explain my emotional response now. He says, these are the things, again, things that undermine our credibility. These are the things that have been used forever against women making these types of allegations. To me, the lesson of Me Too, of the Me Too movement, is not that you believe every allegation. Of course not, no. The lesson is to take allegations seriously, to swiftly investigate the facts surrounding them as best as one can, while leaving aside the worst age-old instincts to drag the women who make these claims through the mud. Again, the group most guilty of that is the I don't care group, not the group that took the time to formulate an argument.
Right.
And this is an example of how guys like Chris Hayes, and some women do it too, but a lot of white straight men hijack these discussions. White straight cisgendered men, I should say, because a transgendered man can be straight. They hijack this to go, hey, women's issue, I'm going to use this to talk about what's important to me, which is in Chris Hayes's instance is, I want to look consistently perfectly liberal, right? He's wrong. His logic is faulty. The I don't care has been an issue for women for a much longer part of human history than the attacks on the credibility. The attacks on the credibility only came about when all of a sudden people were forced by law and popular opinion to give a shit. Yeah. And we've only been living in that world for 30 to 40 years. Rah, Hulk. There is an example of me being spitting angry, but I'm still allowed to, I'm still able to think critically.
Take note, people.
And that's what people have to start doing. That's where I'm gonna come in on this, of the topic of how to get people to think critically, right? This is what I had to learn to do. Step one. Realize you're angry. Admit you're angry. There's a reason you're angry. Something is sitting wrong with you. You and Mouse, you and me have this in common, because we both have moments where it's like, rah, like we get pissed at something. And we make up new swear words and create interesting swear word combos, and we get past that. And then we start digging into why this made us so angry. And I fumed about that Chris Hayes response, I think for 2 days before I finally figured out what was wrong with it. There was some instinctual thing that just went bullshit, 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 bullshit on me, but I couldn't find the tangible detail to unlock the problem. And then I realized, well, it's like, break it down. Wait a minute. His core assertion that not finding an individual woman credible is the worst thing you can do with a sexual assault allegation. No, that means they gave somebody an opportunity to be credible and they failed the test. The worst thing you can do regarding a sexual assault allegation, no matter who's making it, is say, is dismiss it, which is what the whole believe women mantra was designed to combat against. It did not start as believe all women. It started as believe women, meaning don't be in that second group. But Chris Hayes commits the political extremist, you know, equivalent of the old slapstick comedians who stepped on a rake or stepped on a mop and it comes up and smacks them in the face.
Yes.
He's all going, look what a great person I am. These are serious issues. I'm an ally, and totally shits the bed on critical thought. Then I'm in the really shitty position that I end up in too often, because I deeply care about these issues to go, I appreciate your spunk, sir. Bad choice of words in this topic. However, yes. You are wrong. And the problem is, on certain issues, on both the right and the left, I have most experience with the right. I have most experience with the left, because that's where my politics moral line, mostly by process of elimination. But I get the, you are disagreeing with me, therefore you don't care about this issue. wrong. I care deeply about this issue. And every time somebody high-placed like this says something this wrong-headed, I have to correct it, because if I don't, someone else will. And if someone on the right with a bad faith agenda does it, it hurts the cause.
Mm-hmm. That's when you, it allows people to poison the well.
Yeah, because he is wrong. And anybody who, you know, like a Donald Trump, who 25 accusers of sexual harassment or worse, mm-hmm. Somebody like a Harvey Weinstein, who, you know, he's a dirtbag. He gave to political people who probably didn't know about it. Both can be true. Mm-hmm. You know, political people have to deal with a lot of scumbags because they want their money. It doesn't mean they're influencing their policy. But, you know, someone, I don't want to make the fallacy of people on the right don't care about sexual assault. Jim Jordan situation aside, that has made me very angry.
Mm-hmm.
But people on the right definitely don't mind the convenience of the old school, why are you ruining his life? Women lie about these things, you know, combo, right?
Oh, yeah.
Precisely.
The old boy, the good old boy excuse.
Well, it's the good old boy excuse because they want a way to not have to think about it. They want a way to dismiss it. Now, unfortunately, believe all women is also its own form of dismissal.
Mm-hmm.
Any false certainty is a logical fallacy precisely because it's false.
When you're positing any parameters for judgment,
right,
of a situation or a person, wherein one person must always be believed,
right,
no matter what. And yeah, in this case, we're talking about, you know, you have to take it on faith. You know, you cannot question the facts. You've already you already have stepped outside of critical thinking. It's just a sham.
Which is why Joe Biden's choice of presumes as a word, presumed, mm-hmm, is so critical. And again, I hate having to defend Joe Biden on this point because he drives me crazy. But the fact that he says you must presume that at least the essence of what she's saying is real, that is very clearly a starting point. But yeah, at no point does he say, well, that's it, problem solved. No, no, no. He's clearly talking about the beginning of a process, not the end of it. And the people on the right who just dismiss, she's lying, with no evidence, right? I want to be clear, somebody who looks into it and has reasons why they don't find someone credible. And this goes for people who think Joe Biden did it as well. I can think somebody's wrong and still think they're in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody who doesn't bother to look into it, I've got a friend whose father just thinks Joe Biden's a rapist and should be in jail because Fox News says so. You know, those are the people that are dismissing it. But so too, and I hope people really listen to this, people who take the exact opposite but equally reductive approach, well, he's been accused, therefore he did it. It's the same mistake. It's the, mm-hmm, same laziness. It's an excuse to not get in and look at the details of what really happened here and form your own independent opinion because it's too uncomfortable and it's too hard.
Yeah.
And of course, who's one of the biggest proponents of that? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh boy. And it's too bad because I think she's smart. I think it's really interesting that Kristen Gillibrand shut her mouth this time. That surprised me. I guess she's finally learned that she destroyed her presidential aspirations with the rush to judgment on Al Franken.
Yeah.
Al Franken, remember him? Holy shit.
It was 20 years ago, wasn't it? No. It
seems so long ago. And talk about a situation with nuance that never got a proper investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that might be a place to land, unless you want to add something else. I know I've talked a lot.
No, I think it's very illuminating. And I do think that the points you made about anger are very important, because right now people don't take the second step. They merely acknowledge their anger and use it as a ballistic missile, and then they move on.
Really? I don't think people acknowledge their anger nearly enough.
Well,
because people think if you get angry, you're not rational. And that's a fallacy.
I guess.
Granny Weatherwax again, man. Granny Weatherwax. Granny Weatherwax was always rational, and she was always angry.
Angry, yes. Yes.
She was always angry because Terry Pratchett was writing through his own very rational anger. Anger mm-hmm. can be a scalpel, or it can be a nuclear, it can be a laser, or it can be a nuclear weapon. Right? I changed my metaphor there because I wanted light to light. Lasers burn hot. Lasers can cause a lot of destruction, but you can fucking aim them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Nuclear bombs just take out everything in sight.
I think that's a very good point to end in. I think strive to be a laser, not a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, let the anger burn, but focus it.
Yes.
Take out the right targets. I don't like being angry. I don't like being around people who are angry, so I want to end this quickly. That's understandable. That's mm-hmm. human. That's not critical thinking.
Yeah.
You don't get pay to win in critical thinking. You don't get out of jail free cards in critical thinking. Every problem is the Minotaur's labyrinth. And maybe I'll go play Quest for Glory 6 now. Calm down. I'll go play Doom Eternal. Because that's a perfect game in this mood.
You mean Quest for Glory 5?
Quest for Glory. Oh, 6 was 6 wasn't the one with the Minotaur?
No. There were only 5. 5 is the one with the Minotaur, and it's the one that takes place in Silmaria.
I was thinking King's Quest 6.
Oh, then King's Quest 6.
There was a Minotaur in King's Quest 6, a Minotaur in Quest for Glory 5.
Right. There's Toro.
See, you corrected me. I like that because I was wrong, even though I was just coming up with a funny metaphor, because one of the things I do is when I realize I'm ranting, I make a joke to center myself. Because as long as I can make a joke, I haven't gone full Hulk. You know, then I'm more like in Iron Man mode or maybe snarky sidekick. I'm not totally Hulk smash. I'm still capable because humor and the ability to think critically are very much intertwined. Maybe that's something to talk about another time.
Yeah, that would be an interesting topic.
Humor and critical thinking. I think we need the break after all this horridness.
Yes.
But this has been the Broken Clock podcast on the FU Network. I'm going to do the thing I'm terrible at now, which is plugging the stuffs. FUnetwork.tv is our website. The store.funetwork.tv is where you can buy merchandise for the FU Network, one-time PayPal donation through funetwork.tv. You can also support us on Patreon, patreon.com/funetwork.tv, if you like this kind of stuff, because thinking is good for you, even though it hurts sometimes and frigging enrages you from time mm-hmm. to time. Mouse, you have the last word because I've been ranting.
Stay focused.
Why? It's so hard right now.
This is fun! The FU Network!